Do I want to be 40 telling 25-year-old, 35-year-old virgins how to like be normal in public? And the answer is absolutely not. So I just basically made a conscious choice to not do those topics anymore. And what I found was a massive uptick in audience because I started to get men and women who were like, yeah, I'm a professional doctor, lawyer, whatever, engineer, married, two kids, love your show, instead of, hey, I'm 17 and I've never had a girlfriend, love your show.
This is the Angles of Latitude podcast, session number 145 with social dynamics expert and the Larry King of podcasting, Jordan Harbinger.
This is squadron leader confirming hostiles inbound. Prepare for battle.
What you're about to hear is the integration of life.
Clarity is power.
If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right.
Liberty.
We choose to go to the moon.
It's happening.
And all things geek.
Yeah, I'm not sure I know how to answer that.
You got a badass over here.
Welcome to the Angles of Latitude podcast.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us today. I'm your host, JC Preston, founder of New Inceptions, and co-hosting today again is Harrison Painter, founder of Amplify Indie. If this is the first time you're listening in, this is the show where we bring you life lessons or a message from successful entrepreneurs, athletes, experts, and artists to help you find and execute your own personal mission and live a lifestyle that you're proud of. Today, I got to say I have a very, very special treat for you guys. You know, first, just to kind of give you guys a little bit of context, you know, when I opted to go back to grad school back in 2007, I felt I needed to take it upon myself to learn about subjects that hadn't been covered much in the classes up to that point. And mainly because, you know, when I first went to college, I thought I was going to learn about all kinds of things. And the truth is that really, I only learned how to be an engineer. I really didn't learn many life skills. So I thought really going into college, that was what it was all going to be geared towards, you know, helping me learn more about how to think and not what to think. Well, when I started this new path of mine, I found myself curious about the four things that really aren't to be discussed too much around the dinner table. You know, money, religion, sex, and politics. Money and success and religion were mainly covered by the people I was meeting in LTD and other entrepreneurial circles at the time. So I was kind of on my own to learn about sex, relationships, politics, things like that. And, you know, politics was something that my parents had always been paying attention to. So I started listening more to the people that they had listened to. And eventually, you know, I found people that I still listen to this day. And when it came to sex and relationships, I had to remember that there was a host of a show back in high school whose name is Drew Pinsky. And you might have heard of him as Dr. Drew on his show Loveline. And over the years, Dr. Drew has worked with many folks, including Adam Carolla. They actually have a new show now, if you didn't know that. But Drew was the guy that turned me on to today's guest, Jordan Harbinger. Like me, Jordan is a product of the Midwest and the Big Ten, and I think that's a big part of the reason I've been able to relate with him so well over the years. Add to this the transition he's had to go through this past year. It makes me realize that sometimes you just have to move on to greener pastures. In this conversation, I find out all kinds of things I've wanted to ask him over the years, some of which complements the interview he did recently with Cal Fussman. And some of these topics include what prompted him to leave the Midwest in the first place, why he went to law school, and some ways he continues to get better at his craft of interviewing. But before we get to that, I'm going to remind you guys about Fizzle. And guys, I have to tell you something. I'm excited for those of you who have recently been taking your first step and making your business idea a reality. I've been getting some really great feedback recently about Fizzle. And in fact, one person even said, I can't believe I didn't know this place existed, especially with all the people who have content on the website. And yes, you know, besides coaching, community, and the courses I've mentioned and before, there is a few courses done by people like John Lee Dumas and Caleb Wojnak, who is actually Pat Flynn's friend and videographer. But there's also these videos called Founder Stories that features these same guys, including Jordan. and many other people you'd probably know if you follow internet business celebrities a bit. But they all talk about how they got their businesses off the ground and made it into what they have today. So tons of great information here, guys. Can't recommend Fizzle enough. Again, get started today free for 2 weeks by visiting newinceptions.com/fizzle. All right, before we get started, I want to remind you guys to leave a review on iTunes. One of the last session's guests, Alex Dumas, made the effort to do so after his session 144 was published. He said, JC and Harrison run a top-notch program. I'm grateful that I was able to connect with them and be featured on an episode. They're great podcast hosts, and they asked great questions and deliver the goods. And Alex, really appreciate those kind words, man. Thanks for taking the time and to drop in that review. And really, you and Sarah were really great guests, and really look forward to the things that you guys got going over there on your show. Remember, if you drop us a review on iTunes, I'll be sure to give you a shout out in the future. Not only that, but you know, doing so helps other people find the show, which means we can help them do more fulfilling work themselves. Also, don't forget, I'm slowly archiving older sessions of the show, so be sure to check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/newinceptions to get access to those classic conversations. And that said, show notes and show note extras of this conversation can be found at newinceptions.com/145. And as usual, I'll be on after the show to fill you in on anything we might have missed. Everyone, welcome back to the show. This is JC Preston, and with me today is co-host Harrison Painter. Thank you for joining us today. Harrison, what is up, my friend? How you doing?
Man, life is good. We just had our live pre-show podcast for the Walk the Talk speaker series happening here in Indianapolis. We got to do a preview at the dress rehearsal of the six speakers. It's just an incredible event, man. Very excited to be a part of it and be able to capture some of those interviews.
Right. And we're going to be showing up in force at the event on February 20th, right?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. We've got a full VIP section. We've got special VIP lanyards. We're getting everybody, and we're actually going to have a bunch of signs like what you would hold up at a football game or whatever to cheer on the speakers. So we're going to get rowdy, and we're going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah. For a TED Talk-like experience, having a VIP section like that's going to be something different. But hey, it is what it is. It'll be fun, right?
It's Amplify Indie, baby.
That's right. That's right. But as we're recording this, this is actually the week of Valentine's Day, or as I mentioned in the last session back in college, I actually referred to it as Singles Awareness Day. But today's guest, once upon a time, helped single guys remedy that situation. Me being one of those guys that actually tuned in from time to time. But since then, he's been on an awesome journey to help people with all kinds of issues, you know, when it comes to interacting with other people. And he does this through his podcast, where he not only interviews top quality guests, but he also has a Q&A weekly episode with his producer, Jason, as well as he offers a free course where he helps students confidently command any social situation in 30 days. Today, we're speaking with no other than Jordan Harbinger, who can be found at jordanharbinger.com. Jordan, thanks for joining us, man. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate the opportunity. I know this took a while to get set up, and now we're finally doing it.
Yes. Been looking forward to a while, and pretty cool to finally get you on. But recently, you actually had someone on your show that I think you were wanting to get on for a pretty long time. And I got to say, I've been listening to you on and off since 2011. And I think I actually heard you on Pat Flynn's podcast as one of his early guests. And I think I also heard a commercial on some sort of sex-related podcast or something that, you know, a guy that's single and whatever was paying attention to.
But what were you listening to, man? Do tell.
But that was kind of the circle that you were in back then, and things have definitely changed. You've started your own company, you've gotten married, like myself, and really, you know, you've stepped into your own game with the help of your small team over there. Recently, then this was really cool. Recently, you actually were featured on a Big Questions podcast with Cal Fussman, in which I'll have linked in the show notes, where he got to actually learn a lot more about your journey. And he asked questions. You know, you were talking about how we've been trying to get this
interview going for a while. Well, he asked a lot of the questions that I actually wanted to find out in his particular chat. So again, I'll have those in the show notes. But one of the things that was really able to resonate with your story that was very similar to mine is that you were originally from the Midwest and you grew up near Detroit. I visited the Traverse City, Charlevoix area on a yearly basis, still try to get up there as much as I can. But tell me what it was like for you growing up in Southern Michigan back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I remember always being bored. And when I finally started traveling, I was like, oh, the whole world is not necessarily this boring. And that was a good thing because I started to get not in trouble, but like minor things. And my mom was like, uh-oh. And so when I wanted to become an exchange student and go abroad, she was like, yeah, this is probably a good idea because she'd traveled too. And she knew that I knew that there was other stuff out there, but I was really just stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was quite important for my development because it really, really could have been bad. And a lot of my friends were getting in trouble too. And she kind of realized he's getting in trouble because there's just nothing to do here. And I always feel bad when, you know, you hear about like meth problems and opiate problems
America. Totally. It's so huge in Indiana, man, for sure.
Yeah. And like you hear, oh, well, unemployment's really bad and, you know, it's a depressed area. But the truth is, and look, I'm no drug counselor. I'm no expert on law enforcement or drug addiction. But I will tell you, I would put dollars to donuts that it's because people are super bored.
Mm.
There's just nothing to do. Like, how many times can you go to Waffle House, right?
Exactly. And that brings up a point. Like, I know that you and Jason talk about documentaries all the time on your show and recommendations. Have you heard of there's a documentary series on Hulu called, and it's by Viceland, called Abandoned. And it looks at different places around, I would say, North America that have changed so much from their, like, back in the day times. And one of those places is St. Louis, which if you look at an aerial view of St. Louis, I mean, it has been completely like Detroit has just gone by the wayside. And, you know, I think that during the time that we were actually around, you know, the prime time for both of those cities and many in the Midwest, you know, had already come and passed.
Yeah, Flint, Michigan was already a major dump by like the mid-90s.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, but hey, at least we still were able to be kids in the 90s, right?
Yeah. But it's scary because it sort of makes you think like, oh man, bummer. And then, you know, you move out to, I don't know, Silicon Valley or something, and you're like, good thing I don't live in Detroit. And I'm far less worried about the tech companies going the way of the automotive companies because it's just so unlikely, but it's not impossible.
Right.
It's not.
Right.
I think, luckily, the idea that the thing that killed Detroit, and we don't have to go down this rabbit hole too much, but the thing that killed Detroit was, in my opinion, this is very, very controversial, in large part, the unions, and they're not singularly to blame, but they definitely contributed to making it unfeasibly, just impossible economically for Ford and GM to keep people there.
Right.
Because
100% agree. I actually worked at Ford Motor Company for 12 years.
Oh, okay. So you know what I'm talking about.
Totally understand, because we had certain restrictions, like you could only make so many pieces of product. Even if you got it done in 4 hours and you have an 8-hour shift, there was still just X amount of parts that could be made. And the unions put all these type of restrictions on people that instead of incentivizing them to produce or be better, to make a better product overall, it just incentivized people to do the bare minimum.
You don't want to make the lazy guy who showed up drunk look bad, right?
Right.
So they
right.
lower everything to the lowest common denominator. My dad worked at Ford and was not, contrary to what people will say as a counter argument, like, oh, your dad is probably some executive. No, he worked in quality control and was an engineer and, you know, worked his way up from like the tire company that fed Ford to Ford. And he also largely blames the unions because he's like, by the time I retired, guys who were doing jobs that robots could do were making like $35 an hour.
Yeah.
And yeah, the robot costs like $3 million, but it paid for itself in like 3 months, right? Because it could do the job of 8 people that needed like health insurance, wanted to work for 4 hours a day, got, you know, like all of this stuff. And it's safer. And they were like, let's replace these guys. And the unions were like, we're going to go on strike. And eventually it was just like, look, we can't pay you $40 an hour to do something a machine can do. And then you're going to complain about it. And then we have to worry about whether or not you're going to just stop working because some other thing isn't going your way. Like, it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work.
You know, one of the other Midwest towns, Pittsburgh, right, is just completely union ran. And I don't see how, you know, Cleveland died. I don't see how Pittsburgh can still be as relevant as it continues to be. It must have something to do with their sports or something, because, you know, they have rowdy fans. But yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So you went to U of M, University of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
I'm a Purdue grad, so go Big Ten. Yeah. Happy about that. But just like so many of us who were graduating in the mid 2000s, you had a bit of a wake-up call at graduation. The real world, you know, threw you like me for a loop, and you went back to school fairly quickly to get your law degree. Let's go back on that one a bit. What made you take that step?
Well, like a lot of people like a lot of people in sort of our position back then, I thought the solution was going to be the solution to essentially not being able to get a job at freaking Best Buy, for example. Mm-hmm. I thought the solution was, well, obviously I just need more education.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Right. Right.
Because, you know, that was the wisdom of the parents was like, look, you got to go to college and then you'll get a great job. And then I figured, okay, well, if college isn't enough now, I got to go to grad school.
Yeah.
And then of course people are like, what do you want to study? And they're like, don't do anything but engineering, computer science, medicine, or law. And it's like, I don't want to be a doctor. I didn't take any of the prereqs. I'm not really going to be an engineer. So it was almost like this default, like, you should be a lawyer. You're good at talking, which is like the dumbest thing anyone ever says. But non-lawyers say that all the time. So I just decided to apply to law school. And then I ended up getting into Ohio State, actually. And I went to the orientation. And next to me was the quarterback of my high school football team. Nice guy, friends with him all through high school, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, didn't do well in most of our classes. And I thought, I did not work this hard in undergrad and to get into the same exact place as this guy who was like in remedial everything in high school. And I thought, I need to shoot higher. And so I applied to Michigan, didn't get in, and then wrote to them and sort of said, look, if you let me in, I'll delay my legal education by a year. And so they let me in.
Okay.
And Michigan was a totally different ballgame. Like, Michigan was, I think, number 6 in the whole country for law. And Ohio State was, like, I don't know, in the 50s. So it was a dramatic difference. So, because I just kind of went there and, like, my ego was like, hell no, you're not sitting next to Bill Sherman. Love you, Bill. But no, not happening. Not happening.
That's so funny. Like, going from Michigan to Ohio State, that would have been a trip in upon itself. But,
well, that was another thing that was annoying, is people were like, oh, I guess we'll let you go to school here. And I was like, cool, only 3 years of this BS. I don't even care. You know, like, I just do not care at all, because I'm not into football or college sports. So I thought, great, I'm gonna have to like deal with this, like, these jabs, and I'm not gonna care about it. It's like not worth it. So for me, I was just like, okay, that was just one of a billion reasons why I was like, no, thanks. I'm not doing this.
That is crazy. But wow. So you get through law school and do well there. You get hired by a company, I believe, in New York, right? And let me know if I'm wrong, but I think it was, they were commodity trading, or what were they doing again?
Oh, yeah. Mortgage-backed securities is what I did.
Ooh, that sounds exciting.
Oh, yeah. You have no idea. So, yeah, that was next level. You know what, though? I liked working there because the guys were cool, the guys that I worked with. There was, like, one girl. That's why I say guys. But, you know, it was fun. And I'm going to one of the guys' bachelor parties pretty soon. So I liked working there, but the work itself wasn't some sort of rewarding thing. That was really interesting. But you weren't, here's the thing that separates us generationally, not you and I don't think, but like me from other people. It was, there was no expectation when I started working on Wall Street that you would enjoy your job. Like, that is a freaking joke. Like, oh, I don't find purpose in your, like, nobody was going, you know, I need to find more purpose in my work. I need to find something that I find. Are you kidding? No, you have a great job. You're making 160 grand a year. It's more than your parents made at the peak of their careers. It's your first year out of school. Like, just shut up and show up to the office. There was nobody, no dialogue anywhere, online, offline. Nowhere was it discussed that you should find your job fun, interesting, reward. Like, none of that was part of the zeitgeist at that time.
Oh, dude, and that's totally why I went through and put up with engineering when I was going through undergrad. And then once I got out, I'm like, taking, was a few internships that told me that I should go back to grad school, because it was just like, yeah, I have no interest in doing any of this for the rest of my career. Oh, hell no. So
yeah,
it's just, is this what you did to get, you know, make money? And that was what we were taught, I think, as a generation to really follow, you know. It's like, follow what's responsible and earns, you know, pays the bills. So, oh yeah. While you were there, you actually started your first podcast. And I remember a few times when on the show, you were actually, you made it a point, because you would have female listeners write in and say, hey, can you make this more gender neutral of a show? And, you know, have these kinds.
I was like, no thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Multiple times you were saying this. And I think this is the time that my wife and I were actually both listening in. And I think she was my fiance at the time. And I'm kind of curious.
What did she think about that?
Well, funny enough, she liked it. She liked the show. And in fact, some of her more social awkward friends and underlings in the military, she would forward it to them and be like, this is what you need to listen to. I can't babysit you, but listen to this. So that's what
nice.
She saw it as. But you ended up going more into big league guests while you were still over there. And I'm kind of curious, I mean, what led you into, for one, how were you able to get those first couple of big leaguers, and what led you into kind of branching out and talking to different people there?
Went
you there?
So what happened was, I was doing the dating and relationship stuff for like 8+ years. Then I was reading books, and I would have the occasional big author on, like Robert Greene or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember once on my seventh anniversary of the show. We just had the 12th anniversary of me doing shows now with the Jordan Harbinger show. But back then it was like the 7th anniversary. And Robert goes, why didn't we do this earlier? And I was like, oh, I didn't want to waste your time. I wanted it to be really good. And he goes, dude, this is, I mean, he didn't say dude, but he goes, this is one of the best interviews that I've done. And I've been doing media forever. I've been a writer for like, you know, 20, 30 years, whatever it was. And I was like, what? So he really prompted me to take it more seriously and get really interested in the craft of kicking butt in interviews. And so I started to upgrade my craft of interviewing. And that's when I realized that if you don't settle for what people will give you and you try to get the best out of them, you're going to find that there's a certain caliber of guest that just doesn't cut the mustard, so to speak.
Mm.
And a lot of these guys that were just not cut, guys and gals that were just not cutting it.
Mm.
And that was what I found. A lot of these like men's coaches were, a lot of these like lifestyle guys and gals were, dating stuff was all kind of the same thing. And I started to grow out of that. And then I met my now wife and I went, okay, after like a year, I was like, if I have to do another show on nonverbal communication, first impressions for first dates, I'm going to gouge my eyes out with a spoon and a rusty grapefruit spoon, to be precise. And so I just did not want to do it anymore. And so I started to focus on more Robert Greene, you know, more like, hey, why don't I get this really smart person on board? I read their book. They're really interesting. Oh, let's get down on this. And I started to get really good interviews and people were like, oh, this is cool. And there was a certain contingent of the audience that was like, oh, can you go back to more readily practical topics? And I was like, these are practical. It's just not about you getting laid. So no, I'm not going to go back. And a lot of people were like, I'm going to unsubscribe. But more people, far more people were like, oh, great, I can share this with my friends because this is interesting and they're married and they don't want to listen to this. So So I started to get listeners like that. And then when I branched into the Jordan Harbinger show, I got dozens of emails, hundreds possibly, that were like, great, I can share this with my friends now because I don't have to say, yeah, it's called The Art of Charm, but it's not as douchey as it sounds. Now it's called The Jordan Harbinger Show, and I can get great guests, and they don't go, do I want to do a show called this? This is ridiculous, you know? So I'm getting better guests. It's more true to the brand, and I just don't have to go pander to that sort of... Because the loudest part of the audience was, like, these bro guys, but eventually you outgrow them. Mm-hmm. And the best fans grow with you. And what was happening with all the dating stuff was I would get an email from somebody that's like, hey, I just got married and I wanted to thank you. You really helped me get to where I am today. Da, 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 da. And I go, great. What do you think of the new episodes? And I'm like, dude, I'm not listening to the show. I met this great girl and I got married. Didn't you hear me? And I'm like, oh. So what was happening was all the great, normal, well-adjusted men that were listening, they all outgrew what we were doing. And the guys that were like 38 and still hadn't had a girlfriend or kissed anyone were like, can you do a show on blah, blah? And I was like, do I want to be 40 telling 25-year-old, 35-year-old virgins how to like be normal in public? And the answer is absolutely not. So I just basically made a conscious choice to not do those topics anymore. And what I found was a massive uptick in audience because I started to get men and women who were like, yeah, I'm a professional, doctor, lawyer, whatever, engineer, married, two kids, love your show, instead of, hey, I'm 17 and I've never had a girlfriend, love your show. There is a distinct difference. Like, don't get me wrong, I love helping people that need it. I'm not looking down on those guys. But at a certain point, I've got, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 900 to 1,000 hours of audio online. If the first 900 hours, 800 hours didn't get you over the hump, I'm not really sure what else I can do for you.
Oh, wow. Well, and I think as a creative, you would just get bored, you know?
And I was dying.
And I think that that's what you touched on when you were on Srini's show. And you were talking about that as a creative. And then you were also talking about recently, and we had Michael O'Neill on the show. When you were on his show, you were talking about more along the lines of this and how you've been going building a business from scratch. And so, Harrison, what do you think?
What, building a business from scratch?
Yeah, well, because that's what you're doing in Amplify, right?
Well, that's what I've done a few times. And I think I'm one of those, I love the pain. I love the hustle. I love the challenge. I love the trenches. I love everything about it. But one thing I want to touch on with Jordan, of course, is that startup trenches, man. I know you've been down there too, and it went really well when it went well. And of course, it goes south when it goes south. We don't want to go in the weeds with kind of the past or any of the negative stuff in the transition, but the current Jordan Harbinger brand is a year old, correct?
Yeah, since the break-off? Just this month, it's a year old. Yeah, crazy.
So 1 year, and if my math is correct, you actually started podcasting in 2007?
2006 is when I started, like December 2006. Sorry, I had to think about that for a second.
2006. So think about that. That was even before the iPhone, right? Because the iPhone, I think, was 2008.
Yeah, I remember being like, seeing the iPhone, my friend had gotten it, and then I went out and got it like immediately. Couldn't afford it. Whatever, who cares, right? I already had like $168,000 in law school debt. I was like, I want this. I'm getting it. I have since paid off all my student loans, and I have no debt. Thank you very much, except for my mortgage and my house. Just so people aren't like, you irresponsible POS. But I got the phone, and I went, oh my gosh, I know they're saying like, oh gee, it's got all my music and you have your phone contacts. But I was like, the data on this is going to be the game changer. Like, I can surf the web on the phone. What else is going to happen? And I remember reading like, oh, they might allow apps. And I thought, if they allow apps, there's going to be an app for podcasts.
Yes.
And it's going to be better than the iTunes app on the phone. And I remember looking around and being like, who else knows about this? Who's thinking about this? So we started there. And I remember telling people with iPhones, like, hey, do you know about podcasts? Most people didn't. And I'd be like, check it out. I have a podcast on there. And people were like, oh my gosh, you have your own podcast, which is, you know, hilarious. And they were amazed that I was on their phone. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe you're on the phone. And so it was very, very future. And I remember one of my law professors being like, man, you're in the wrong business. There's something here. You know, there's something here.
Well, it's incredible, man. I remember when the iPhone first came out. So I had a show briefly for about 6 months. We were doing five shows a week. It was insane. Jeez. But we were live streaming them. We were doing them on Ustream. And then it would pipe in. We were actually the very first social media based kind of interview show that was ever featured on Ustream, their mobile app. And it was an amazing time because this would have been 2008, I believe. But, you know, we grabbed, like, Gary Vaynerchuk was on his way up. We grabbed Bob Berg. We just grabbed some really cool people because it was such an exciting time to be in the space. But here's my big question, because now you're 12 years into it. And what advice could you give somebody starting today? Because you and me started in a time where it was exciting. People were very accessible. Granted, the technology wasn't as easy as it is today. But I do feel people were much more accessible back then than say today with all the noise. So you, how can a younger person right now starting a podcast, what kind of path could they take to get better guests as they keep going?
You know, this is the thing, like people ask me this all the time and this is also controversial, but like, maybe you'll agree, maybe not. You definitely don't have to. It is your show after all. I don't think you need to get good guests. I think people get, in large part, they get the guests that they freaking deserve. And I will say this. Usually you get the guests that are just under the tier that you deserve, generally. Like, I think that most people who are sort of interviewing their mom could probably do fine with, like, the average author. And the people that are interviewing the average author would be fine with, like, an author that's got some titles under their belt. And the people doing that could interview a best-selling author who's done a lot of media and be fine. Like, usually you're kind of punching just at or below your weight because of the noise. But people are often like, I've got a podcast and I want to know how to book great guests. And it's like, why? And if you keep asking why, you get down to this sort of truth that I think is unhealthy, which is they go, well, and this isn't universal, but a lot of people will say, well, if I get guests like Darren Brown, who's a household name in the UK, famous illusionist, I just interviewed him. I've been trying to get him for like 10 years or more. If I get him, then more people will listen to the show. And it's like, you know, that's not really true. Like, yeah, if you got Obama and you get a bunch of press around it, or you get like Donald Trump to go on your podcast, yeah, you'll get some new listeners. They'll stick with you. They'll be impressed. But generally, the guests aren't what bring people to your show unless you have an absolutely insane amount of access. Like, if you are an average celebrity and you're not that good of a host, but you're sort of entertaining, but you know a crap load of celebrities and you can call like Tom Cruise and he'll show up and do your podcast, yeah, you should leverage that. But for most hosts, they're these young guys and gals that are like, I want people to listen. But it's like, why? Oh, well, validate. And then it gets down to some stuff like validation, ego. They want to be an influencer. They want to leverage their email list to sell some product. But what have you done to really earn that? You know, you don't have interview chops. You're just kind of middle of the road. You don't look at these news interviewers that are like on, people who get really great guests are on like 60 Minutes. Those guys are all like 70 years old or 45 at the youngest, right? On 60 Minutes. And they're doing like stories. Somebody interviewing somebody major, they're pushing 50 and, or they're a Vanderbilt like Anderson Cooper, right? They're right. Not people that just were like, you know what? I want to do interviews. Why can't I get Will Smith? It's right. Like, because you didn't earn it. You're not there.
Or they're not in the network. Like, you know, someone like, have you heard, I know you don't follow sports, but really used to be the punter of the Colts, Pat McAfee. Have you heard of his show?
I have, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he had the luck to, because not everybody knows what they want to do when they get out of school, let alone the NFL. He had the luck to get hired by Barstool. And that gave him access to a network to quickly become good at his craft, or considered good at his craft.
But to be fair, though, that dude is extremely talented out of the box, though.
He is. I mean, it's definitely a certain kind of humor, but, you know, it's just so interesting to think about how, because of that talent, that actually kind of going to what Jordan teaches. It's not all about talent, but in his case, it is. You know, it's like, I think it's that talent that really helped him get to where he's at. But
for sure. But also remember, he's got a sports background. He does a sports show.
Mm-hmm.
He's done that sport since what, middle school?
True.
So yeah. You add that to his 10,000 hours. He's probably been talking about sports since then, too. Because usually if you're into sports, you're watching games and you're seeing other announcers talk about it. You're watching SportsCenter. You're hearing people talk about the game. And then suddenly you have to turn on a microphone, but you're also kind of funny. Well, congratulations. Now you got credibility because you were a former pro athlete and you've got a microphone in front of you and you get to leverage everything you've been doing for like 20 years. Right. So when I look at what I'm doing, I'll often be like, oh man, why can't I get a so-and-so guest that was on Rogan? And often I will work my ass off and get there, but sometimes I won't. And I'm thinking, oh, well, when I was like popping zits, Rogan was the host of Fear Factor.
True.
Right? So True. He was already in on mainstream television, having probably busted his ass in comedy and auditions and all this other BS for like years prior to that. And then he rode the wave of MMA and got into that. So like people who think, oh, I can do what Rogan does because they think they're kind of funny and they can hold a conversation in front of a microphone. It's like, no, you can't. You're not doing the same thing. There's not the same appeal. You don't even see what's going on because you don't understand. And then, you know, you look at Marin and people are like, oh man, I'm not a huge fan of what his conversations are like. But bear in mind, this is one of those things where this guy had been a comedian for, I don't know, 20 plus years before starting a show. So he was used to this self-examination. He had a good sense of humor. He'd been writing jokes, successful or not. And so a lot of times people will see anyone, this isn't just for podcasting, we'll see someone's success and we'll be like, why can't I do that? I should start an app. And it's like, you know, that guy worked at Microsoft for like 10 years, right? You know that he was in the space of, he was in the payment space for 15 years prior to founding XYZ or being on the board of this. Or like he worked at Facebook for a while and then cashed out and is now, like, we don't see that stuff. We just think like, oh, they just started and they raised $100 million. Wah, I should do that. You don't have the ability. You don't.
Have you considered studying comedy as a way to get better at your craft?
Yeah, and I honestly don't totally know what to do. Like, I've taken improv classes, and I kind of maxed out my teachers, like, within the first, like, 2 weeks. Not that I was so hilarious or anything, but I was like, eh, I'm not really learning a whole lot more of, like, throw the ball and think on your feet. Like, I'm very quick on my feet. I did live radio for 3 years. So I don't really, there's only so much of, like, toss the beanbag that you can play. Mm-hmm. And then everything above that and improv was like, now we're going to learn how to construct improv shows. And I was like, not interested. Mm. Very interested in a very specific skill set. Now, had I lived still in LA, it's very unfortunate that I lived across from UCB, Upright Citizens Brigade, for like 4 years. Never took a single class when I lived in LA. Now I live in San Jose and I talk with like Adam Carolla and he's like, go to UCB, go to Groundlings. And I'm like, dude, I don't live in freaking LA anymore, man. You know? So I don't have the same access, but I definitely think about doing a lot of different class. I don't just think about this. I do take classes on Skype, but it's just not the same, you know? So there's a part of me that's like, maybe I should go to New York for a whole summer and just take like 3 hours a day, different classes at Second City and just bust my butt, you know, with really good teachers and spend like $20,000 on the opportunity or more to just get in the best and get it done. But it's very difficult to do that kind of thing. Like you can't, it's not like making up for lost time. Like, oh, I'll just hire Tracy Morgan to live in my garage. Like you can't really do that.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I've noticed for you is you're such a proponent of continuing to learn. Like, it seems to me that there's a lot of, when you get into the grind, you almost forget to learn, so to speak, when you're building your business. And you're one of like the, you and your friend, Jim Quick, you know, you guys, huge about exercising your brain. For one, let's start with how important it is to continue to exercise your brain. But if someone is having problems taking the time to start a course, what can they do about that?
I think people should realize that, and look, I'm not judging because I was the same way. Like I said, lived across from UCB, never occurred to me to take comedy classes or any of that stuff. I think long game, like, this is why I don't worry. People will go, oh man, so-and-so like crap head podcaster that only has YouTubers on and has like a big YouTube channel, they got this guy on, and I'll be jealous for a second. And then I go, ah, that's cool, but it's short term. Mm-hmm. Like, you might get some big name on your show, but when people who are finding you because of that find out that you're asking high school newspaper level questions of your guests, they're done with you forever. Mm-hmm. You know, until they forget that they heard you and you suck. So I'm playing long game where I'm like, look, I'll talk to neuroscientists and authors and I'll get the occasional celebrity on and I'll do some really interesting shows and I will work my ass off. And then one day I'll be on Viceland or like CNN and people will be like, wow, this guy just started his career and look, he's got his own show. And they'll be like, calm down. I worked my butt off to get up here and I've been, you know, having my work shredded. Like I recently paid $8,000 for essentially 2 hours of consulting with one of CNN's top broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't do consulting. And I was like, cool, how much is it? And he's like, I don't do consulting. And I was like, great, how much for 2 hours? And he was like, $8,000, I'll listen to a bunch of your shows and then we'll do an hour long session and then I'll listen to a bunch more and we'll do another hour. And I was like, great, where do I send the money? And he's like, crap, I was hoping I outpriced you. And I was like, no, I want, you know, he wrote a whole book on this. He teaches at Columbia Journalism School. And he's like, I've never really taught anyone this. And I was like, if you don't think you bring it, then just give me another hour to make up for it. And he's like, okay, I get it. You know, so, but I want this. So he's like, I'm buying access to these people that don't sell their time for a ridiculous amount of money because I know that there's a damn good chance that the only people who can help me get to where I want to go. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a really good chance that you're a crappy writer. But if you hire a writing coach, they can get you so far. But then you're going to want to hire Stephen Pressfield because he's the best writer. Or you're going to want to hire Chuck Palahniuk or whatever, right? And they're going to go, I don't have time for this crap. And you're going to go, cool, I'm going to sleep in your backyard. And they're going to be like, all right, send over your stupid manuscript, you little shit. You know, like, they're going to want to see that. And then if you've earned your seat at the table, they'll go, okay, I get it. Mm. We can do this. Mm. You know, but until then, you're just kind of begging for table scraps and you're annoying people. Mm-hmm. But if you put your money where your mouth is, they'll spend the time with you and then you get a chance to show off your talent. You don't, until then, you don't get a chance to prove yourself because you tried. Right. You have to earn your seat at the table. And sometimes that means buying your way there, or it means being like, hey, the reason I'm picking you is because I think you're the only one who can help me. I've taken 78 courses on writing. I've read 58 books on interviewing. I did a, you know, unpaid internship for an NPR show when I was 40. You know, like, you got to do this stuff. And if you don't, you can't expect people to give you a seat at the table. And that, like, right now, one thing that I'm working on, I don't even know if I'm allowed to talk about this, but whatever, I'll try to keep it vague. I'm helping an author with, or I should say, I'm trying to continue to help an author who's known as one of the world's greatest interviewers with a book about interviewing. And I'm like, can I be your research assistant and be the one who like flies out with you with gear to interview the world's greatest interviewers and then take notes and organize it and then sort of co-write this book? And he was like, I guess. I didn't think I needed that, but that might be a good idea. Now I'm like, hell yeah, because of course now I'm going to be like, hey, me and so-and-so are doing this book on interviewing and we want to meet with you. And we've already got, you know, Larry King and Katie Couric and blah, 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 blah. So of course I'm going to get in front of Charlie Rose and Anderson Cooper, you know, of course, like, we're going to leverage the crap out of this, but I can't do it myself. You know, you've got to work your butt off with these other people and then you can start to do stuff on your own. But nobody really wants to do that now. People are like, oh, I want to have a breakout hit. It's like, well, okay, cool. Good plan.
So I got to ask you this because you've had a lot of success up till now. I believe you're up to, what, 4 million on the podcast,
five,
right?
Yeah, five.
Five million. But what's the top of the mountain look like for you? What are you truly shooting for? What's kind of that long game? Where do you want to go?
Yeah, what I would love to do is bring the interview format to something like television, because I realize not many people, Well, what a lot of people have said is, look, not everybody wants to watch long form. And I was like, cool, yeah, Joe Rogan, you're never going to have a business. Sorry for the 90 million people or whatever that are downloading your stuff every month. You know, like, but that's just not true. And I realize, you know, it might not be something where everybody wants to watch it on Netflix, but 60 Minutes ratings are pretty damn good, you know? News stations, something like this, like news networks, there's a place for this long format interview stuff on TV or alternative TV, which is online. And I'm down for that. I would love that because the more people that watch and listen, the more fun this is and the bigger a difference I can sort of make in people's lives. And that's what's really fun for me. So I've gone through the ringer on this because I look at what a lot of people are doing and they're like, oh, you know, you need more Instagram followers. You need to become an influencer. And I find all of that just a massive distraction. Like, yeah, okay, I should build a YouTube channel. Great. But there's a lot of people building YouTube channels and they just suck. There's nothing there. And they might have a lot of subscribers, but I'm just not convinced that that's the way to go. And I think people are choosing these vanity metrics like Instagram followers and YouTube subscribers. They're valuing that over the actual substance. And it works short term. Like young 20-year-old kids who don't want to get a job are eating this stuff up. Mm-hmm. But if you want to talk to smart people, it's a smaller audience, but it's a more valuable audience. And so I'm aiming for that. Hmm.
One of the things that I've noticed quite a bit about where you're at versus where you've been is, you know, we've mentioned this, is that you're now married. Jen is like the head of production, basically, right? She's pretty much your producer mm-hmm. behind the scenes. It seems, since your AOC days, much less stressed out. At least it comes that way. You're
totally
a lot more personable.
Funny.
And it's just like, even the way that you banter between you and Jason on the Friday shows is just so, it's just so cool to see that side of you. And as a fan, and one of the things that you've picked up since Mary and Jen is that you guys have started beekeeping. How did you get into that, and what else are you allowing yourself to experience outside of the grind these days?
Yeah, my wife loves beekeeping. You know, I think it's fun. It's funny. It's not super much my thing. I'm also doing a lot more interesting sort of travel. I'm advising some startups. Mm-hmm. I enjoy that stuff. I wasn't able to do any of that before, because yeah, like you said, I was stressed out to the max.
Right.
And I'm doing a lot of different stuff that I never got a chance to do before. I'm working harder somehow, and yet I'm happier. It's funny how that works, but that's a whole different discussion about like toxic work environment and all this other stuff.
Yeah, which you can hear plenty much on Cal's interview of you. So I'll just let people listen to that interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should touch on the fact, too. Look, you create a lot of value for people. You give a lot away for free. I know some people think that's crazy. You know, we give a lot of stuff away for free here on the local level with Amplify Indy. I know that Gary Vaynerchuk really preaches that. What do you say to people when they say, dude, you could monetize so much of this stuff?
Oh, yeah. Like right now, I've got 6-Minute Networking. It used to be called Level 1, but now it's called 6-Minute Networking. And I've filmed this and I developed these drills over years, and like, it's pretty great. And a lot of people are like, holy crap, I just got a raise. Or the networking or the negotiation class that I did with Alex Kutz, it's like 3 hours long with worksheets. People are like, hey, I just saved $100,000 on a house or a remodel because of this. And I'm like, yeah, my mission is give stuff away that is so valuable that people are like, you're crazy if you don't listen to this Jordan Harbinger show. Like, you're freaking insane if you don't. And then when I do offer a course, people will be like, I have the proof of this. I did a live event last year in November, and I was like, I'm only going to do 30 seats. I don't really want 100 people in the room. I sent out the email. We had this whole 10-week marketing plan. I sent out one email that was like, hey, preliminary interest list. If you want to just buy it, you can go to this link, but you know, we're going to be sending you more details soon. It sold out in like 3 hours and nobody asked for more info until after they were paid. Love and it. I was like, what? And people who came were like, I honestly have no idea what we're going to do. I just knew that I had to like light up your course. And I just bought as soon as I got the email. And I thought, that is insane. You know, that's really cool. So I want to give away the negotiation class. I want to give away the networking class. And then when I do like a hybrid negotiation networking masterclass with experts and worksheets and different videos and homework and accountability, people will be like, yeah, this is worth $2,000 because the free thing was worth $100,000. It's just a credibility thing, you know, and since I'm not a marketer, I don't believe, well, I don't, everyone's a marketer. I'm not like an internet slimeball marketer. So I'm not like learn the secrets of blah, blah. Like, I don't care. Look, I'm going to teach you stuff that you know is valuable because you already learned a bunch of it from me and it was also valuable. So I'm not like trying to tease. I'm not trying to hide the ball and tease it. There's just no reason. You just know when I'm telling the truth, I'm telling the truth.
Yeah. Cool. So before we end the show, always do the rapid fire question segment amongst our guests. And I have to, here's the thing. I know that there are some podcasts that probably helped you become a podcaster yourself. Some, you know, maybe what was the Social Media Examiner might have been one or something like that. But what are some of your three favorite influential podcasts that helped you get where you're at?
Ooh, I mean, stuff I listen to now, it's hard for me to be like, oh, it helped me a bunch of years ago. I mean, I listen to like James Altucher, Tom Bilyeu's good. I have, you know, I listen to Sam Harris, but I don't know if I'm like, oh, that Sam Harris technique, you know, I'm going to use that. But I learned different ways of thinking from really intelligent people. So I would say those guys are pretty much up there. Like, Tom Bilyeu is a good interviewer, so he gets some, and he gets some interesting people that I would never bother really trying to get myself, probably. So I learn a lot from that. James Altucher is a very different kind of thinker, so I learned from him on that. And he's a good friend of mine, so I can kind of like get inside his head. It's kind of nice. And Sam Harris is also a friend of mine and really interesting and smart. So he helps me think about things in different ways, you know. So, but I'm not like, ooh, I listened to the Pat Flynn Show, which is also another good one, and was like, here's this marketing tactic I'm going to use. Like, I could get that from a guy like Pat Flynn especially, mm-hmm. and he's a smart dude to listen to, but I don't really get much instruction that I then go turn around and apply my business from podcasts. You know, I learn how to think from podcasts, which is, you know, subjectively, that's more important.
Right. Actually. Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
So here's a question for you, and I'm going to frame this. I know it's supposed to be rapid fire, but like, I don't get starstruck very often, even though I've been blessed to meet a lot of really famous and incredible people. But I will say this, the one man that starstruck me was when I met Nolan Bushnell. If you guys know who that is, it shows you how big of a nerd that I am. But he was the founder of Atari and Chuck E. Cheese, first guy to hire Steve Jobs, right? So it was the first time in my life I met a guy and I didn't know what to say, right? I was like just that five-year-old boy again. But I need to ask you, Jordan, so who would be someone, or maybe it's already happened, but if you interviewed them that you would truly be starstruck by?
Good question. I don't know, because I don't really get a lot of that feeling. I do get nervous sometimes because I don't want to screw up interviews, but that almost never has to do with whether the person is a star. Like, I was nervous around Shaq, and he's a star, but I was also nervous around, like, you know, Jane McGonigal or something, even though we're, like, buddies. Because I was just like, this is going to be so good, you know? So, I get that. But I don't know. Good question. I'm sure that there is a level at which that would happen, though. Right? Like, but is starstruck the right kind of, I think,
like
by the time.
Like a president, right? A president.
Yeah, but even then,
probably.
I think I would just be more like, don't screw it up. Rather than be like, oh my God, it's so-and-so. I really don't know. And I'm trying to think who my top gets would be. And a lot of times I would probably be more nervous about not screwing it up rather than being like, I need an autograph. Let's take a selfie.
One that comes to mind that you did do a lot of that in was Gary V's, like two times ago, I think. Where you
did a lot of what?
Research and study and making sure that you didn't screw it up. And he even mentioned it in the interview, if I remember correctly. He's like, man, you really know your stuff. You know where I'm from, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, that's how you prepare for a show if you don't want to screw up.
Yeah, I did. Well, that wasn't just like not screw it up, but it was just Gary Vaynerchuk's done hundreds of interviews. 99.9% they're the same.
Mm.
And so to stand out, I had to be like, okay, what's the next level thing?
Gotcha.
And that was going down that rabbit hole like crazy. You know, it's really tough for me to think of who I would really be like just shocked or starstruck. I'm looking
like nobody from your childhood. Like,
man,
nobody you really looked up to when you were, you know, in the 90s when you were young.
I was never really that guy. Like, I never really looked at someone and went like, they're so cool. And even if they were, I admired them, but I can't imagine that I would get starstruck or nervous around them at all, frankly. Mm-hmm. No, I really don't think so.
It's an odd feeling because Nolan's the only one that's ever done that to me. But I look at that. There's a guy that molded my entire childhood between Atari and Chuck E. Cheese. Right. And then, of course, Apple with Steve Jobs and whatnot. But I'm with you. Like, I don't get nervous very often. Now, I don't interview big people anymore. But you know what? I enjoy just interviewing people. Like right now, we're focused on just interviewing local folks that are doing incredible things, which I do want to touch just real quick on, because I think what you said was so important. Hone your skills, get better. It doesn't matter how big the guest is, and it shouldn't matter who's in that chair. Do the most amazing job you can do for the person that's sitting in that chair. And I don't think a lot of the younger folks, or even a lot of the newer folks, I should say, always think about that.
Yeah. That's extremely true. They just think they've got the person and then they just have to sort of make it through the conversation. That's not really how it goes, you know? And I feel bad. I don't have anybody on my list where I would be starstruck. Like, I think it's very possible that there's going to be somebody who's so magnetic and charismatic that I would then become that way. And I just can't imagine it. Like, I think if I was around somebody who's had to captivate the entire world, like Barack Obama, I might be like, yeah, I'll be fine. And then I might be like, damn, this is awesome. Oh my God. In the moment. Right.
Mm.
But I don't really know
Elon?
Who else would. Yeah. But at the same time, like I don't know, maybe one of the reasons I'm good at this after 12 years of trying is because I'm too busy thinking about other stuff to get starstruck. I have 8,000 things going through my head during a show. I don't have time to be like, oh my God, Elon's here. You know, I just don't. I just don't have that.
Well, hey, let me ask you this too, because you're very tied in to everything, but what's one issue or topic that you really feel people should be talking about that they're not?
Hmm. Good question. I think one thing that people aren't talking about that they should be is the idea. Well, you know, this is sort of a rabbit hole too, but people are really big on this authenticity stuff. And yet the people who are biggest on it are the fakest ones. They're the Instagram influencers. They're the people writing self-help books. Those are the fakest people around. They're absolutely the fakest with few exceptions. And it's making people feel bad. And a topic I wrote about why self-help makes us feel bad. And I think that there should be a counterpoint to all this self-help BS, not just positive thinking BS, but self-help BS in general. And that's not sort of a global issue that people need to be talking about, but it's affecting a lot of people that are in the internet personal growth niche because, you know, we look at someone and we're like, they're so authentic, and they're not. Like, the guy who's teaching everybody to be, like, an honorable man is sitting there cheating on his girlfriend or his wife.
Mm.
The guy who's like, build business and build value is a freaking scam artist who's for sure going to be in jail in, like, 5 or 10 years for all kinds of fraudulent practice, business practice. You know, and yet they've got these huge events. And nobody can blow the whistle on these guys because you'll become a target and because all these fanboys online are like going after them. But I just try to sort of stay in my lane and be honest and take smart people and go, psst, look at that. That's BS, right? And they go, yeah. We kind of thought so. Thanks for confirming. So that to me is something people should be talking about. The idea that anybody who's giving you something out there has something to sell, including me. The difference I like to think that I bring to the table is I'm telling you what's for sale and what's not. Courses are free, but I tell you when I am selling a course that isn't, right? Whereas a lot of these self-help guys will be like, hey, I'm not selling anything, but if you want to come to my event, just pay for the ticket and I'll donate something, blah, blah, blah. So basically it's free. And then I'll show you how to make 10 times your amount of money during my seminar. And it's like, no. That's a con, right? You're couching it like you're doing a charity and you want to share the wealth, but you're selling this. And so I think teaching people critical thinking and how to dissect what people's sort of angle is, that's something that should be more commonplace and unfortunately is not yet.
Wow. Nice. Got two more questions for you. One, first one, since you travel a lot, what is one tip for traveling?
Bring duct tape. You always need duct tape. You'd be shocked at how valuable duct tape is. People go, no, I don't need to bring duct tape. Oh, cool. Your bag rips. You need duct tape. Oh, you got a cut? Duct tape. Oh, you need stitches, but there's no doctor around? Duct tape. Oh, your pants ripped? Duct tape. I literally keep a little thing of duct tape in my bag, and people always laugh, and then they're like, you'll never guess what happened, and I'm like, I don't need to know. I got duct tape.
That's what MacGyver would say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, and the last question, what's the secret to achieving personal freedom?
Always be learning. You know, that might be even cliche. Give without the expectation of anything in return. You know, give. Consistently get people what they want. Don't even think about what's in it for you. Eventually, when you need something, you'll just be like, hey, network, anybody know about this? And you'll have like 8 billion people trying to help you because you gave without the expectation of anything in return for years. You know, you basically banked all that goodwill. That's what saves my butt when I had to restart.
Exactly. I was just about to say that too. So anyway, thank you again so much for joining us, Jordan. It's been a long time coming. Appreciate the time that you have been able to spend with us today. And people, again, can find you at jordanharbinger.com these days.
Yep.
Where can people find you on the socials?
At Jordan Harbinger on Instagram and Twitter, and then jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And of course, the Jordan Harbinger Show is where I be at.
Well, again, totally appreciate you being here with us, and it was great.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Awesome. Thank you, sir.
All right. There you go, guys. Really glad I had the opportunity to have this chat. And as Jordan said, it took us a while to get together. His schedule was totally slammed in 2018 while developing his new brand. So yeah, I completely understand why it took us almost, I think it was like 6 months or something to get him on the horn. That said though, I highly recommend you go check out his interview with Cal Fussman to get more details about his comeback story. Lots of things in there that I had really no idea about. And in fact, some of the questions that Cal asked were ones that, again, I was wanting to find out myself. So I was like, thank you, Cal. I can find out, do a follow-up question for that now. But also in the show note extras, I have a few other interviews. Two of the interviews are ones that he was actually guest on. And then I have two interviews, which I guess you could say are recent favorites of mine. The first one is with a past guest of this show, Isaac Litsky. And he was actually a guest on Jordan's show as well. And in their conversation, Jordan talks a bit more about reinvention of himself and some of the things he was dealing with last year at this time. Then, because Jordan mentioned he listens to him fairly regularly, I have him being interviewed by Tom Bilyeu. And after that, I have Jordan interviewing one of my favorite people, Cesar Millan. Really great talk, especially if you're into Cesar's show. And finally, I have one of the interviews I listened to right before the conversation with Jordan. In it, he's talking to Cal Newport about digital minimalism and how many of us creators are doing ourselves a disservice by feeling that we need to be on social media all the time. So be sure to check those out via the show notes at newinceptions.com/145. So that's it for this session, guys. Remember, if you want to have access to an amazing collection of courses by various creators, as well as their founder stories, be sure to check out Fizzle. Again, you can get your first 2 weeks free by visiting newinceptions.com/fizzle. Thank you for spending a little bit of time with Harrison, Jordan, and me today. Always appreciate having you here. And until next time, gang, dig in, have fun, and take care in whatever you're creating. And we'll see you back here next time.
Thanks for listening to the Angles of Latitude podcast. Connect with us at home, at work, or on the go at facebook.com/newinceptions, on Twitter @newinceptions, Instagram at new.inceptions and on the web at newinceptions.com.